They're getting the gavel, but we'll use my pencil for now. Welcome to the February 27th Capital Investment Committee meeting. We're going to hear a series of presentations tonight, starting with the Department of Natural Resources, followed by the Pollution Control Agency, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and finally the Department of Agriculture. And to get us, lead us off and get us going, I'd like to call Ken Lacosmo to the desk, to the witness table. And Mr. Lacosmo, welcome. You're a regular around here. We all know you, and we all have come over the years to appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Kent Lacosmo, the Director of Capital Investment for DNR. And, you know, as you know, we've changed a little bit how we're doing the capital budget, so we don't have each division here. And I don't pretend to know all the intricacies of each division, but if you have questions, I'm sure we can get them answered. The in your packets, I believe you each have a copy of the PowerPoint, and you also have our fact sheet, so you can
Mr. Lacosmo, that's correct.
And the way this the technology is working today, I think we're going to get two slides per page up here, but that's all right. The as you know, on the bottom slide there, DNR works to balance the outdoor recreation, economic development, and natural resource protection. And we should be able to. We have conservation that works is the. Is the new administration's goal. And our mission there is to work with the citizens and conserve and manage state's natural resources, provide for outdoor recreation, and to provide for commercial uses of the natural resources. And the four goals listed are the goals of this administration, to conserve and enhance the natural resources, make sure the outdoor recreation system is diverse and of high quality, and manage all of those natural resources to contribute to strong and sustainable jobs, economies, and communities. Oops. The bottom one on this, on the next page, is as we put this together, this capital investment, we looked at, again, maintaining a strong conservation infrastructure. And DNR, as you know, is a large agency. We've got a lot of work locations, a lot of varied work sites, capital assets worth more than $1 billion. And we also looked at creating jobs and supporting the local economies. And as an example, look at the forest products industry as the state's fourth largest manufacturing sector. Their total annual economic impact is $18 billion, and 89,000 jobs. Fishing, hunting, wildlife watching generate $4.3 billion. Statewide trail activities is 43,000 jobs. And you add up all the monies that for the various fishing, hunting, trails, boatings, it's over $30 billion a year. So it's a significant addition to Minnesota's economy. Our budget process this year, we identified from the divisions the needs from each division, and that process came up with about $360 million in capital needs. We discussed that internally and got that number down to a $160 million prioritized request, 22 different program areas. That's what we submitted as a preliminary request to the governor's office and MMB. And the governor's office recommendation is $55.5 million, and that's what we're here to discuss today. We look at maintaining a strong infrastructure. We've got more than 5 million acres of state land that we manage, lots of buildings, recreational facilities. We want to ensure that that's all done to ensure the safety and health of Minnesotans, improve the delivery of conservation services, improve recreational opportunities, reducing costs, and increasing efficiency. So these requests are things like asset preservation, roads and bridges, parks and trails. And as you all know, we've got a lot of those facilities. It's over 1,400 wildlife management areas, 840 miles of aquatic management areas, 150 scientific natural areas, 58 state forests of 4.2 million acres, 1,600 public accesses, a significant amount of infrastructure. DNR has more than 200 work sites across the state, and we have recreational facilities in every county of the state. We have more than 2,700 buildings and facilities, and that's buildings that range from an outhouse to a large regional office building. We can put this money to work quickly. We have, we estimate, I think the kind of standard is for every $1 million spent on construction, that supports 24 jobs. And we are able to spend money fast. In fiscal 10 and fiscal 11, we spent almost $90 million each year. In calendar year 11, it was about $170 million, if you look at calendar years. The flood hazard mitigation funding out of the 2010 capital budget, we've spent about 98%+ of that money already. And the 2011 flood hazard money, there was $50 million appropriated. We've spent about $44 million of that already. The asset preservation last year, we've got $14 million of the $17 million allotted to specific projects. Not all of that has been spent yet, but we know where it's going. A lot of it went to St. Croix Park after the windstorm. You know, basically every building out there needed a new roof. And also the elevator shaft renewal at Sudan Mine after the fire there. And then across the state, we've also done another 43 roofs that are either done or in the process of being constructed. The actual recommendations in the governor's budget are the bottom slide here. Flood hazard mitigation was $20 million. Dam repair reconstruction, $7 million. Natural resources, asset preservation, $3 million. The water access, aquatic invasives, 12. Groundwater monitoring, $500,000. RIM critical habitat matches, $3 million. Roads and bridges, $5 million. And the parks and trails renewal and development was $5 million. And I'll go over some of these in a little more specifics. The flood hazard mitigation, which you've seen a lot of over the last few years, and so far right now it's at least looking good that we won't have a flood in the Red River Valley after having them there for the last 3 years running. This
there's no snow. That trip north too.
The flood hazard mitigation program provides cost shares to local governments, we've made significant progress since 1988. We've removed 2,500 homes from the floodplain, so they aren't there to be damaged anymore. And if you look just specifically at Moorhead, since 2009, they've bought out and removed from the floodplain 176 homes. So they've made significant progress since 2009. The background and the photo on the bottom right, you can see that's just a ring levee around a farmstead. But basically in the Red River Valley, that's what you're doing around the small communities is building a ring levee so they're protected because you have flooding that extends for miles wide. I know when we did discuss this, Mr. Chairman, when you were in Moorhead at on a tour. And we are making progress with this program. There's significantly less damage and less damage potential that exists in the state now due to the funding that's been provided over the last decade.
Excuse me, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we're very thankful that it looks like we won't have a flood up in the Red River Valley. But could you enlighten us a little more on what's happening, the number of communities that are in the process of or will have to be in the process of renewing their or recertifying their levies. It would be nice not to have to do to do anything when you don't have a flood to fight, but there's a lot of communities, it seems like, that have the federal government has come in and said that they have to recertify the existing levies.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump.
Mr. Rockefeller.
The federal government, FEMA, has required that all the levies in the state are examined to see if they meet current standards. And the standards have been probably changed a little bit and increased, and that's due to the reaction from the hurricane and the flooding in New Orleans. So what happened is there are communities that have to make improvements to their levies to remain a certified levy. Having a certified levy means that the people that live within that are treated like they aren't in the floodplain, so they don't have to buy flood insurance. We would encourage them all to buy flood insurance because you can always have something happen like happened in Rushford, where those people all live behind a certified levee, but they had a bigger storm. And I think two or three homes had flood insurance, but they, you know, they ended up essentially all being flooded. So having the flood insurance is still a good idea. But communities are worried about having to spend money. And the time frame that the FEMA has is relatively aggressive. But I think if we're making progress and designing the projects process of getting funding and constructing these, I don't know that they would be eliminated. I think those projects with FEMA will be put on the bottom of the pile. If somebody's not making any progress or trying to do it, then they could end up having a non-certified levy. And that would mean any new loans or any new activity that's with a government loan, they would be required to have flood insurance.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Senator Langsitt.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Locke this morning mentioned the $50 million last year. I believe there were, what was it, about 16 different projects that have been completed now because of the funding that we've done. I believe that was the
juice here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Langsitt, I believe it's 19.
And there's some others. The big one, I suppose, was East Grand Forks and Warren, and Breckenridge is almost ready to finish up this coming summer. That $50 million that we got last year really did move things along, and that's about what it would take again this time. If that were to happen after that, the amount could drop down quite significantly every year. Morehead could actually be done a year from this next fall if they get the proper amount of money. But the $20 million is about what Morehead needs, and that's all that the governor had recommended in his recommendation. So I think it's going to have to be quite a bit higher than that because this would just push ahead an awful lot of the problems, and they're all ready to go.
Not quite in the capital.
No. Mr. Oxmoke, can you... The top slide there, that first line, and I'm trying to, program provides cost share grants to local units of government to design and so on and so forth. Is the cost share part, is that based on some formula? I'm believing maybe some communities do cost share and others don't. But maybe I'm wrong.
No, Mr. Chairman, there is a cost share from each community unless there's been a rider in the authorizing legislation that didn't require it. The underlying program that's in the statute is 50-50 cost share. But over time, what's happened, and this happened, it began, I think, with East Grand Forks, because we would, under the 50-50 cost share, we would split the non-federal share 50-50. The non-federal share at East Grand Forks was about $65 million, and a town of that size couldn't afford the 30-some million of the local cost share. So the scenario that was developed at that time was that the local contribution was limited to 2% of the median household income times the number of households. So that, and that's not statutory. That's just been included as rider language with each bonding bill since the 1997 flood. So there is, we look at the current census data and determine those numbers. So, for example, this year, as we do new grants, we're using the 2010 census numbers. So some cities, their cost share has gone up. Morehead's under that 2% scenario went from a little over $8 million to a little over $12
million. Okay.
So there is a local cost share. Some of these small communities along the Red River Valley, for example, are small communities with low median incomes, so their cost shares are relatively small.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? If not, continue on.
Just let me see here. I think we covered most of this on flood hazard mitigation, but we are looking at our main priority is to purchase and remove homes from the floodplain. So that's been the most effective, although there are other types of construction projects, levees, flood walls. And the demand for this year's funding, the projects that we know about, exceed $100 million. They aren't probably all totally ready to go, but there are a lot that could be constructed if funding was available. The next area is the dam repair, reconstruction, removal. In the governor's budget, there are $7 million. There's over 800 publicly owned dams in Minnesota. 430 of those are state-owned. So on a state-owned dam, we would pay 100% of the cost. On a publicly owned dam by a city or a county, there's a cost-share grant agreement of 50-50 cost-share. This is another high-hazard or another infrastructure kind of thing where they're going to wear out over time. A lot of these dams are over 50 years old and need major work. The top dam in the picture is Billsby, which is a high-hazard dam. High-hazard means if this dam fails, there is a significant risk of loss of life. And they're under FERC has required them to make some changes to their overflow spillway. And this also was a local government request for the state to fund their share, or the state's share. They have their match money. And that would be our highest priority project is the Billsby Dam. The dam on the bottom here is the Coon Rapids Dam, and we believe that was funded last year. We don't have final bids or anything on the project, so there could be a little cost overrun, but that was funded in the bill last year. And the project priorities for the other 15 dams that we would expect to do with this appropriation are those dams that were identified in the dam safety priority list that is provided to the legislature in the odd-numbered years. The bottom of this slide is the natural resources asset preservation. And as you know, in 2009, there's a broader definition of asset preservation for DNR, which is it extends to all DNR facilities. We've really focused on dealing with buildings and the roofs that were leaking. With last year's appropriation, we were able to address a bunch of that. But still, there's a significant backlog of need dealing with code compliance, hazardous materials, air quality improvements, making these buildings fit for our employees.
Excuse me, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Loxmo. I wanted to understand a little bit more about that Lake Billsby Dam. You said FERC had some?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer. They produce hydropower at this dam, so the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has some authority over what is required for them to keep their license. And okay. They have to make improvements so they can pass the probable maximum flood.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lacasmo. So I guess I'd be a little bit – I myself would like a little more information on that because I'm trying to understand – I mean, if there's issues with the dam plus FERC and you know, how does that – it sounds like that might be more of an issue than other dams, and that's why it's on the top of the list, but I'd like to understand a little bit more about that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, we can provide you more specific information, but this isn't being done just because FERC says we should do it. I mean, we do inspections annually of the high-hazard dams, and we agree with their assessment of need and what needs to be done. Well, we can provide you some more specifics from our dam safety report and the work that we believe needs to be done.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Loxmo, and I can't resist, if you YouTube Lake Billsby as about 2 years ago, you will see a little clip of more water than you can ever imagine coming over that dam. It was just unbelievable.
Really?
And it held. Mr. Loxmo.
So asset preservation continues to be a high priority need for the department. We have a more than $500 million backlog for all asset preservation needs, and that's the trail rehabilitation, the buildings that we have, water wells, septic systems. This picture is a picture of St. Croix State Park and redoing a roof after the wind damage. Bottom of this page is the water access renewal and aquatic invasives. And I know in invasive species management is getting a lot of discussion this year here. We are looking at designing and constructing a deterrent barrier for Asian carp. We're having discussions now with the Corps of Engineers to see what couldn't be put in their locks and dams. And you know, there's discussion whether or not that should be electric barrier, bubble barriers, other types of facilities, and we're having conversations with the Corps on the specific barrier issue. On public accesses or water accesses renewal, we want to configure our existing accesses so they're better suited to deal with the invasives issue. Having an area to pull off for the decontamination stations, for the power washing the boats, have something like that at various sites. And we'd be looking at the sites that get a lot of use and that are on existing waters that are infected. The top site here is groundwater monitoring. This request was for $500,000, and this would install some probably about four deep monitoring wells and replace 20 shallow monitoring wells. And the Clean Water Fund has funded some of this work in the past. The Clean Water Fund, however, limited that work to the metro area. This request would be spent in outstate Minnesota, and most likely in southeastern Minnesota, Houston and Winona counties, and I think another site up in, I think we're talking about Marshall County or in that general vicinity. And 75% of the people in Minnesota rely on groundwater for their drinking water, so it's something that we want to make sure we continue to manage wisely. RIM critical habitat match is the next slide. This program provides match for land acquisition and improvement of wildlife management areas, scientific natural areas, aquatic management areas, state parks, state forests. This leverages private donations of either land or cash, and currently we would need this appropriation to fully utilize the donations that are expected. And since 1986, there's been $44.4 million leveraged in private donations, which amounted to 79,000 acres of public land or easements purchased with those funds. This is a program where they've been able to spend their money relatively quickly. In the roads and bridges area, as you'll recall, last year we combined our roads and bridges request all into one, so you aren't going to hear separately about forest roads and then parks roads and wildlife management roads. And we have more than 3,000 miles of roads and bridges and that provide access to 5 million acres of state lands. You can see this, the before and after in this picture. And this was in the Bedora Forest. So the after obviously looks a whole lot safer than the before. And we estimate our roads and bridge system is a capital asset that's worth more than $100 million. So this request will attack that problem. And our estimate for the distribution of those funds, there would probably be about $3 million that went towards forestry roads, $1.5 million for parks roads, and about $500,000 for wildlife roads. The parks and trails renewal and development, you know, we had originally requested in our request to the MMB and the governor's office $30.5 million. There's $5 million in the governor's budget. And so our focus would be at that level would be on renewal. And Mr. Chairman, you'll remember that we made a presentation last fall when you were in Brainerd, and our presentation at that time was based on our request of $30.5 million. And we had, you know, a significant amount for trail renewal and development, acquisition, and then also parks and trails grants. But at this request, we would focus on a couple areas, mostly renewals. Like I said, the Itasca bike trail of probably $1 million, trail renewal at several trails of $1.3 million of renewal in parks, the Afton group camp, and some camper cabins. So it's significantly scaled down from our original request. And, Mr. Chairman, that is the extent of the request that is in the governor's budget, and I could answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Metzen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lockett, on this asset preservation stuff, you talked about the horrific storms we had the last year or so, and you mentioned particularly the St. Croix Park damages. Are we self-insured like we are with our campuses? Maybe I should know this, but I don't. Because you're talking about a lot of money for the repairs to the roofs and the siding and stuff.
Mr. Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mentzen, yes, we are self-insured. But if you recall, there was a disaster declared. So we're in the process. We will get some reimbursement from FEMA for some of these damages.
Okay, so that we are, Mr. Chairman and members, we have to pay the repairs if a natural disaster. Okay. I thought that was the case. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? If not, obviously, if you have questions after the fact, Mr. Lacasmo is always there and available and happy to help. So thank you so much for being here tonight. We will move on. And next, representing the Pollution Control Agency, Myrna Hallback. Is that right, Myrna?
That's correct, sir.
Welcome to the committee, and we look forward to your testimony. Which, by the way, we have in our packet as well. So,
I'll get started while the computer is trying to get itself going. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members
Welcome.
Of the committee. Here we go. We just got to start. My name is Myrna Hallback. I'm the Assistant Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I appreciate the chance to present the governor's budget request relative to bonding for the agency. Our bonding request breaks down into three areas, one for the capital assistance program, one for the closed landfill program, and one for a new grants program relative to stormwater pond maintenance. And I will go through those each at a time and let you know. The request is for a little bit over $18 million. And I think there are some successes that we can discuss with you through the process here. Our first area is the capital assistance program. And I have both the program manager, but I want to acknowledge that Brian Sams and John Mitchell from Redwood County have come, as well as Steve Skoog from Becker County. So we have some experts, should you want to talk about those projects in specific terms, that could answer questions. The capital assistance program began in 1980 as part of the Waste Management Act, and the program really was intended to help the state move to an integrated solid waste management program. That is, doing everything from reducing the waste we generate to recycling and to manage it in a more healthful way than burying it in the land. Landfilling has costs for us in taking valuable land and creating burial sites, as well as the groundwater issues you'll hear about as we move into the closed landfill program. We have some very good success in this state in an integrated system, and particularly I want to acknowledge that Redwood County itself has 83% recycling. So when we get to their request in this area, I just think it's important that we acknowledge that. It is a statewide program, so this is a grant program by which most of the counties, when you'll see, they will end up putting in three times the dollar for every dollar that the state invests in these programs. Our request for 2012 is $5.6 million. It will help the infrastructure. It will reduce the environmental risks and potential liabilities that we have all experienced with the old landfills that we had closed up. And many of these recycling centers and activities got started in old garages, old pole sheds. To recycle and to manage the waste coming in, it really requires us to do push and move the waste around, and they're not built to handle that. And that's the type of request we're having from the counties to maintain their activities and do it. Myself, I participated in the Goodhue County Recycling Center that is now 20 years old itself, which was quite a high investment at the time to do, and we're talking about counties that still have less than that type of facility to do. So I think it's important that we understand that. Again, here from this slide, you'll see the amount of dollars that we have put in as a state, $61 million, into 94 grants, where it's been matched with $207 at the local level. Plus, all of the local counties and regional groups do pay for the operation and maintenance of these facilities. They regularly invest into them. This is an opportunity for us to help share in that management component. This map shows the areas of interest of counties we have currently. Again, we don't, the grant program doesn't do RFP and a proposal request before we have money. It does the formal process after bonding is completed. And so we may get a few more people that look at for interest, knowing that there's money out there. And then we rank and we do that. And our request is based on our preliminary numbers at this time. We know that these are solid projects. We just don't quite know the exact number till we get those pre-applications in the door. And again, this slide really just shows the total cost and the cost that the we would look at as a maximum that we could share under the grant program, and then what the applicant would put into the cost. And really, there's an incentive here for counties to work together. They are eligible for more dollars in their cost share based on the number of counties that participate. So that we really do encourage regionalization and participation together. And quickly, again, we're requesting about 5.6. We're trying to promote the waste hierarchy that is in state law. Prevention, as you'll notice when we go to the closed landfill, is significantly less than cleaning up after we have the issues. The statewide solid waste infrastructure you might think of as being very similar to wastewater infrastructure, only it's managing our solid waste in terms of, and that's municipals and sanitary districts. And again, some of these are sanitary solid waste districts, and they're managing it at a county and a regional basis. Not dissimilar. And they do create real jobs, including those that are in our handicap facilities that we use disabled adults to work in these facilities. And so they're jobs of all levels, and they're important in those rural areas and communities. This is just contact information. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just stop for a moment if there are any questions on this part of the request.
Any questions, committee? If not, you may proceed.
Okay. At this point, I would like to proceed with the closed landfill program request. And again, I have Jeff Lewis, who is our program manager here, and if you end up in more detail than I can answer. Historically, this program was created in 1994 to help manage the associated risk with the old landfills that we had. By 1994, we had 50 landfills that were on the federal and state Superfund list, and we're about to incur the same kinds of lawsuits that were happening in other states in other countries, where individuals would be sued by those who own the landfill to help pay the cost of cleanup as is required in Superfund. The state proceeded to say, no, this is an obligation of all of us, and moved the landfills into a closed landfill program, of which we have been since 1994, putting the proper covers on them, monitoring them, and maintaining them. I think it's important here to see that to date, the bond requests here have been $104 million on the cleanup side versus the $61 million on the prevention side that we have in the waste hierarchy cap program. So it absolutely cost us more, and the combined effort between the insurance recovery dollars and the remediation are somewhere in $194 million. That's a lot of state dollars that have gone into this program. And as you can see from here, there are many activities we do, which is the cover. We do waste investigation. We sometimes find asbestos.
Yes, excuse me, Senator Jungbarty, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Ms. Halbach. And you'll probably be going over some of this, but as you know, remediation science has gone a long way in the last the last decade. It's come light years. And I'm just wondering, as we go through some of these things, and I see gas extraction is one thing, but there's a lot of contaminatory items within landfills that now sometimes, if you harvest them and separate them out, have a value. And I'm wondering if we're investigating any of those kind of things.
Ms. Halbach?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, at these sites, the waste is such that we don't incorporate much collection and restoration except for the gas mitigation. We do look at it. We have tried to figure out how we could best manage that. But because they're very old and they've at sometimes been burned and they have demo and the other, it's very hard and it's very costly to do that part of it. We do try to, as you'll see in the slides tonight, try to combine them, put them on a smaller footprint, maybe eliminate it off from one site and do some of those. But you're correct. There are options that we know are being employed by the active landfills right now.
Thank you.
Ms. Halbach.
Again, these are just some of the treatments and activities we do at the landfills. Our request for 2012 is $10 million, and it is for the last to begin construction at our last landfill that is in the program. We have one remaining landfill that could come into the program in Burnsville, but that's not yet there. So this is really a success in completing a program, and we hope that we're only here one more time, one more bond request after this to do. But you can see the current sites that we're working on. East Mesaba is the current site actually under construction. Kuching, we are in process of signing a contract to construct this spring and go through it. Hopkins, we would do that starting in the fall to do, and the request for $10 million is for the Flying Cloud landfill site. So Flying Cloud landfill is on approximately 240 acres. We will be reducing that, but as you can see, this is right across from the Flying Cloud Airport to help you orient to it. You can see in the number of red areas, those are developed homes in Eden Prairie. So this is a site existing right in the middle of it. It does have gas issues, and so we want to get in there, control that gas and migration before we risk damage to homes or require very much more specific kinds of activities for them. And so that is what we hope to do. It currently has inadequate slopes on it. The waste footprint is 87 acres, but it's anywhere from 28 to 97 foot thick, which is not unusual for landfills that were constructed along the river or in old gravel pits that you'll have waste at various levels.
Excuse me, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Halbach. And as you talk about the gas collection and things, that's another issue where, you know, as we're looking at gas, are we on board with figuring out gas curves? And I'm assuming in this particular place you've figured that out, that the gas production is minimal and shut down the energy plant. But is that one of the, again, one of the things that goes into these landfills, see how much energy could be harvested out of that?
Ms. Halbach?
Mr. Chair, Senator, indeed, the program tries to harvest as much energy out of this as we can. So we try to put generators on and create electricity. We're also looking at those sites, including some of the sites that will be near recycling centers and the others that we could actually use energy for in the winter on those.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if members are aware, but in Elk River, I believe they have enough energy that comes out of the landfill for about 2,400 homes, if I remember correctly. They run, I think, four generators out of that system. So it's a big thing to be able to harvest that methane as it comes out if it's got enough there.
Thank you. Ms. Halbach?
Mr. Chair, the other issues that we have seen at this landfill because it has not been covered completely is the differential waste settlement, which creates ponding on the landfill, and that increases the leachate and movement of contaminants to groundwater. And so that is part of why we will put a new cover on, and we will shape it, and we will have a better process. And as the senator says, by also managing the waste in a thicker and a new area, we can actually harvest the energy better, too.
Great.
So this is a little tough to see, but we've already started to map the ponding sites. So the blue circles, light blue circles, are where it's already ponding, and that we need to reshape and relook at that and manage it. So what we intend to do is peel back the topsoil, consolidate the waste footprint, and I'll show you that in a moment, reslope the cover so we can get good drainage off of it, manage it, get a synthetic cover, install a new gas extraction system, and then seed the area with permanent grasses. That's pretty standard protocol for us when we're managing particularly sites at this size. So this slide shows how the 87 acres that have been impacted with waste will look like after we're done. So we will move from 87 acres down to 57 acres that has waste. And that allows that other 30 acres to be used as buffer, but also potentially in the future as a different land use as we work with the city on what the future of this site is. Again, the projected cost for this remediation is $18 million, of which we're requesting $10 million in bond dollars, and $8 million will come from the remediation fund. And this is just a summary that we know that we have one landfill probably left. That's the freeway, but this will really complete all of our construction activities except that landfill by 2015. Which is we consider a very successful activity. Then we will be down to operation and maintenance at the landfills, gradually moving those out, and that cost us about $4.5 million a year to do. And they do create jobs with this construction. It keeps our rodent folks going, that bulldozers and construction activities going. The Washington County project alone created 50 direct jobs. So it is important. So I will now stand for any questions on this program as well.
Questions on what she's just covered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langsett.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's, I've heard that the state of Minnesota is way ahead of the other 49 states with these closed landfills. Is that correct?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that would be correct. We were one of the first states to move into Superfund, and we are unique in how we are approaching landfills.
Anyone else? Okay, you can continue on. It looks like into stormwater.
Our next bonding request is associated with the municipal infrastructure regarding the management of stormwater, which is important relative to flood control as well as pollutant control into our rivers and streams. And so what the purpose of this grant program would be is to offset the cost burden for cities as they clean out the sediment in these ponds. And while the design of the infrastructure and basins are for 20 years and they need routine cleaning, the fact that we've grown a little faster than expected has really created some issues for the municipalities. And as you might imagine, those sediment ponds, when they're working, collect everything that's running off from the streets, from our yards, from our driveways, into the ponds. And so it's important that they function accurately and appropriately, both from flood and controlling water quality. So what we're looking at in the program is a 50% match with non-state dollars and a cap of $250,000 per pond. And that the number of ponds that are needed are dependent upon the city and then what condition those ponds are in to do. Since this is a startup project, we've asked for $2.788 million from the general obligation to do it. And then we would put out a grant proposal that would set the criteria and the priority system by which we would do these grants, very similar to what program we would operate under any other system. We've never bonded for this. We haven't asked for it before. But there is a high cost of treating contaminant pond sediments. So it's really a disincentive for our cities to be managing it. If they're most fortunate, this sediment could be used for cover at landfills. Of course, the number of landfills we have is decreasing. So that opportunity does. At the worst case, it needs to be treated because of the heavy metals and other contaminants in it, nearly like a hazardous waste. It has to go to lined industrial facilities, and so that changes the cost drastically.
Mr. Chair. Senator Jungbauer, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Halbach. Once again, when we're looking at the chemical testing on this pond sedimentation, are people looking at that makeup and saying, is there a way to separate out some of these things? Because, again, contaminants today have a value. If you can separate them out, there, a lot of them are good for something else. But what contaminates water can actually be good in small doses in vitamins and stuff. We're finding pharmaceutical companies buying different products that are separated out to use things like selenium and things that you don't think of but are contaminatory in our water supply and in runoff. So I guess I'd be interested in seeing at least a copy if you do like a chem panel or how you do the testing. That's one of the things I do for a living, and we're seeing a lot of neat things out of that. So if there's a way that we can find something to harvest out of that that could pay for some of these projects, that would be a wonderful thing.
So back.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we'll have to get back to you because I'll have to talk to our scientists that I do know are working with the University of Minnesota. I just don't know exactly what they're doing.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Again, the grants will be for flood control and water quality. We will not be funding any of our staff resources. We have staff committed to helping and providing the technical assistance for cities in as they would go through the process and the oversight of the grant programs.
Ms. Halbach, do you know, I suspect this money is going to cities, but does the Department of Transportation have a similar program for those stormwater ponds that are not infrequently located at interchanges and so on and so forth? Are you aware of that?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of their exact program. I do know that they work for folks. They're more on the construction side than the maintenance. And this would be often those kinds of ponds that are right in our residential areas and such as that. So the cities would look at that kind of option and say, can I be funded this way or can I come through this grant program? But we can follow up on that for
Senator
you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about stormwater fees. And I'm thinking about the MS4 permit that's causing such angst and difficulty in my community and maybe others as well. But I'm just wondering, are we funding the same thing here through these MS4 permitting or these fees and then through this bonding request?
Ms. Halbach?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have to get back to the program exactly what they're allowed to use the fees on, but the idea of what we're trying to do with this grant is to take care of kind of the rapid growth and the pond sediment filtration that's happened that cities were really ready for, and then they'd maintain it after that. So it's not an ongoing that every one of their basins would get managed through this grant program, but really that they're we're going to help them catch up to the past years.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Nelson?
So it is kind of the same, we're funding the same thing through different ways. And I guess my question is, how is it that cities then can get state bonding dollars for this stormwater pond restoration while some other cities have to go out and tax their citizens for it? I mean, I'm just, maybe that's a big question, but I'm just curious, how do you determine which cities are going to benefit from this?
Ms. Halbeck?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it won't, a prerequisite to coming into this isn't whether you have a fee set up or don't have a fee set up. It really is based on the need and the way that we typically set up criteria for our grant programs, our highest need, readiness, and ability to manage the grant. So in this case, highest need might be the level of pollutants seen in there, what are the options they have, how long and how old were these, were they built before we set in new protection standards. We fully expect that in all municipalities, the work we're doing both in the construction stormwater to control and keep sediment on the construction sites and working with industrial entities where they're really working on their own sites will reduce the impact to cities and how much they have to maintain. But we're kind of playing a catch-up game here on how municipalities moved forward with getting ponds to control them. And now where we have a lot of need and we've shown the results and the impacts to rivers and lakes. And we have the Clean Water Legacy funds that are doing the after effect to clean up. And we want to get ahead of that sort of game. So this would be part of that implementation process.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Ms. Halbeck?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Halbeck. Senator Nelson kind of opened up a good piece of conversation. Every stormwater pond, even if it's involved in transportation, the permitting actually goes through the PCA. Is that correct?
Ms. Halbeck?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, that's correct.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Halbeck, it would be
Senator Jungbauer.
Good for us, thank you. Good for us to know when these stormwater fees are out there, what fees you charge, if we could get kind of a little cheat sheet on that, because I have the same issue in one of my cities where the city charges a substantial stormwater fee, and I guess sometimes we're concerned, are they charging something that then you're charging for as well, and how are these monies going? Because we don't know with all the fees that are out there today on different things. So if you could tell us what kind of permit fees and things are through the PCA, so then we can kind of line it up and see if our cities are charging something totally different but really should be taking care of the same problem.
Ms. Halbeck?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I could do it. The cost of a construction stormwater permit is $400. And I believe the municipal stormwater and industrial are that same price right now.
Okay. Senator Jungbauer?
So, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Halbeck, so when these cities charge a stormwater fee, that is not connected at all to anything the PCA does or requires?
Ms. Halbeck?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the fees collected at the cities is by authorization through state law, and not through something that we do at the agency. And that was indeed intended to help them with their programs, but they're playing a little bit of catch-up to it. We receive no part of that fee.
Thank you so much.
Senator Higgins, I think. Okay. Anyone else? If not, thank you so much for being here with us tonight, Ms. Halbeck, and we appreciate your testimony and... Again, thank you for taking us through the Pollution Control Agency's requests.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, next we'll move on to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I have, and I'm not sure if you all want to come up at the same time, John McDonald, Julie Blackburn, Sheila Vanney, I guess those three.
Okay.
Okay, I guess we're not going to use that, so...
No, sir. Sorry about that.
Welcome to the committee. I'm not sure who's going to start, but why don't whoever is, just introduce yourself and we'll get going.
I'll get started. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee for giving me the opportunity to discuss this important issue to local transportation officials. I am John McDonald, Faribault County Engineer and the current president of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. On behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Association of Townships, and the Minnesota County Engineers Association, I would like to express our support of the request for the Local Government Roads Wetland Replacement Program. The legislature established this program in 1996, and the state funding level was a result of the stakeholder consensus that resulted in wetland regulatory reforms. Under this program, local road authorities are required to report wetlands lost due to local government road construction. The wetlands are then replaced through the Water and Soil Resources Board. We want to stress the importance of the continued and regular funding of this program, as without it, the requirement to replace these wetlands becomes an unfunded mandate to counties at a time when we are least able to absorb them. Transportation funds, which are already insufficient to meet maintenance and upkeep, will be stretched further, compromising efficient project delivery, and safe roads. A possible result of not funding this program would be an increase in property taxes at a time when citizens are struggling to keep their own budgets afloat. We ask you to support this funding request of $13.1 million to acquire and restore wetlands as required by state and federal regulations. All of the stakeholders involved agree on the benefits of this program and the need to permanently fund this program. We respectfully request that you support this important program. Also, I'd like to introduce Julie Blackburn from the Board of Water and Soil Resources to further explain this program.
Welcome, Ms. Blackburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The proposal that he's referring to is Senate File 1776, and that is for the Wetland Replacement Program, and the bill authors are Gimsey, Ingebrigtsen, and Gazelka. I did provide some information for you about this program, just a little bit of the background on it for your understanding. This program, as Mr. McDonald referred to, was created in 1996. The reason why it was created is because every single road authority must replace their wetlands prior to impacting them. Everybody must do that. That's the law. That's both the federal and the state law. So everybody must do that, and every county, every road authority was responsible for any time they had to do any kind of road alignment or expansion for safety reasons for replacing these wetlands. And it became very, very difficult to do on such minor projects. And so because of a lot of, as Mr. McDonald referred to, a lot of kind of a controversy and stakeholder involvement, in 1996, the legislature said, Bowser, just take that program, streamline it, centralize it, make sure that it's available for local road authorities to use whenever they're expanding roads or creating roads that making changes to roads in order to improve safety. And so that's the benefit of this program, is not every single road authority, meaning county, township, city, has to go through and do their own wetland bank program, at wetland replacement program for any kind of an expansion or safety program. So that's a little bit about the background. If you do have the sheet of information on the inside of it, what you'll see is that on the left side we talk about deposits and on the right side we talk about withdrawals. It is a banking program. It was probably the first eco-service trading program that there was, and that what we need to do is build these wetlands ahead of them being used. And so we build larger, more ecologically sustainable wetlands than little teeny ones that might be replaced individually. And because of that, and because we're doing it in a centralized way, it's much more cost-efficient, much more flexible, and available to use for any of these road authorities. One of the caveats of this program, again, required by both state law and federal policy, is that they must be built in advance of use. The Corps of Engineers requires that we have at least 2 years' worth of credits in our bank in order for it to be kosher with their program, and we currently have been kind of, you know, a bit on the sly with that, a slide, excuse me, on that, and they've been kind of looking the other way. But when we don't have money for the program, they're probably going to get a lot more concerned of whether or not we'll be able to replace those wetlands in advance. So we have a bit of an issue, and you look at the bottom of the left-hand side, the amount of projected withdrawals, and we are not making any deposits into our wetland banking program for local road replacement. On the right-hand side, that's the amount of projected deficits in the future based on road projections. So what we're seeing is that within a very short period of time, we are going to run out of road replacement credits for local road authorities. What that means is that they most likely would have to go through a private banking transaction. There's lots of private bankers out there that sell credits, but it is much more expensive and not as efficient, and may not be, you might not have credits available in your own particular area. So we did just do a little background check. From 2009 to 2011, Bowser, through this program, replaced 278 acres worth of wetland impacts that road authorities had. That required about 475 wetland bank credits. Had this gone through the private banking system, it would have been about $8.7 million. And so it's much more expensive to go through for road authorities to go through that process. So that's a little bit about the background. Again, just to let you know, it was created in 1996 in order to streamline, make it more cost efficient, have more ecologically beneficial wetlands that are created, and really to make it much more efficient for those local units of government who don't have to do these minor credits every single time they do a road expansion. And so with that, I would leave it for any questions you may have.
Questions, Senator Nelson?
Can you give me those statistics again? Between 2009 and 11, or is it in here? How many?
It's not in there. I have it written.
Okay. So how many acres were restored, and how much was it, and how much would it have been had it been at a traditional banking institution?
Mr. Chair and Senators, and when we talk about the banking institution, it is Bowser. We actually hold the bank, even though we don't have any of the wetland credits in it ourselves. We do the transactions, except for other road projects. So from 2009 to 2011, we replaced 278 acres of impacted wetlands. That amounted to 473 credits. Now, credits and acres aren't exactly the same. There's a multiplication factor based on, upland impacts, things like that. So we needed to put in 473 acres of credits. Had those been acquired through the private bank, it would have been $8.7 million. And we did a couple of, just kind of quick projections also through the Bowser Bank, just by using that very simple projection. It was only 6.1. So we're talking about a major savings here by going through this project, as well as really the efficiency at the local level of not needing every single road authority to have that expertise themselves.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Isn't the – when they set up that private banking, wasn't that to try to encourage – availability of credits, and if we just have our public system, don't we kind of pull the rug out from under the private enterprise of these landowners out there that have spent, literally many, many, many dollars to develop a wetland or an acre of wetland or many acres of wetlands?
Ms. Blackburn?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think that's a really great question, and it's a question that comes down to, currently we do have the majority of the banking program is through private transactions. It's through development, whether somebody's putting in, a strip mall, a housing a development, whatever it may be. They go, almost everything goes through the private banking system. One of the reasons why this was created is so that those public authorities aren't held to suddenly very high costs if there is very limited amount of credits available. And so you might have a road authority that puts together a project that they estimate to be, you know, a half a million, $1 million, and then all of a sudden, you know, your credits that you're looking for might be on the private side because maybe they aren't locally available. You have to purchase more because it's outside of your wetland bank service area, which is identified on this map. But if you don't have credits that are available, you have to pay a penalty basically by expanding the amount of credits you're buying somewhere else. And so all of a sudden you might be, you know, looking at, you know, $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 for offsetting your wetlands that you're that you're impacting because of a service or safety issue. And so I think part of it is to really try to make sure it's predictable for local units of government. Many of them are getting bonding themselves through transportation funds. You have a known budget, and so it reduces that risk. But the overwhelming majority of the banking program is through private transactions.
Well, Clarence Dunn.
Mr. Chairman, and another way to satisfy that problem be to just maybe allow local units of government to replace at a 1-to-1 ratio versus a 2-to-1?
Ms. Blackburn?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that that can't be really addressed by this request. That would be a change to the Wetland Conservation Act.
Mr. Blackburn, can I just add, would that be a – does the federal government drive that ratio or is it state government?
Mr. Chair, it's actually we have a very a unified replacement requirement.
And Ms. Blackburn, is it? There are federal regulations in here as well. Are they at 2-to-1?
Mr. Chair, the replacement ratios are very similar between the federal program and our program, and so that's part of the Clean Water Act as well. I think that would be a difficult route to go about meeting the requirement, and we would still have the issue where you still have to replace a credit no matter what.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we still need credits to be available to local units of government. And so it seems like maybe if we want to have a different discussion about the wetland ratios and replacement ratios, we can certainly talk about that. And we've been talking about that at the Senate Environment and Natural Resource Committee. I know there's several bills up that are regarding some of the WACA requirements. I can make sure that, you know, we talk about it there. But as far as this goes, we still, no matter what, need to replace wetland credits when there are wetland impacts, when there are road impacts for safety reasons.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langston.
Mr. Chair, in the past, we've always funded these because it's really a law to do so. But now they have the $13.1 million. And that's for 2 years, and I think we've usually split it year by year, and that we would be, let's say we come up with $6.5 million this bonding year, that would work, right?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Senator Langseth, that's a really good question. Actually, we have received less than 50% of our requests for the last several years. What this request is for about 500 acres just to stay on track with the use. And then it's about another 780 acres, which is to get us in compliance with state law and federal policy for the in-advance use, needing to have those credits deposited in the bank in advance of their use. Just another little caveat on that to let you know, it does take between 5 and 7 years in order to deposit the credits. And so what happens is we go out for bid. We look for where these credits need to be built. We go out for bid looking for people to build wetland credits that we can assume. It takes a couple of years to build those credits, and then the Corps of Engineers has a requirement of monitoring for a period of 4 to 5, possibly 6 years, where they look at both the hydraulic regimen as well as the vegetation and make sure that things are ecologically established before they will allow us to deposit the credits. That's why we are looking at that longer time frame, because it takes so long to get those credits into the bank.
Mr. Chair, the
Senator Langsett.
Administration didn't fund it at all, right, for this year?
Ms. Blackburn.
For this buy-in?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, it was not included in the bonding bill.
Okay. Ms. Blackburn, if you forget the language, if you dumb it all the way down, what is $13.1 million buy? Is it acres of land, or is it this thing you called credits that I'm not sure I understand completely and I don't have to? But this is a capital investment committee, so we should be buying land. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, what you're buying is building wetlands and the land. We assume on behalf of the state permanent conservation easements for that wetland that we build and put in place. And so we hire contractors, we hire surveyors, we go out there and make sure that, you know, it's seeded, it's developed, it's installed, that there's, you know, weirs put in place. It is a construction project.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think with all the flood mitigation projects that we've funded over the years, and I stand to be corrected if I'm not accurate, but I don't believe this. We've built many acres of wetlands. You know, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of acres of wetlands through these projects. And I don't believe the state of Minnesota gets any credit for those acres of wetlands that are produced, and I think we ought to. I mean, I think it's a missed opportunity for us, since we fund the flood mitigation projects to begin with.
Yeah. Ms. Blackburn, I don't know if you have any comments, but.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we do have some of these wetland bank projects that are used and managed by the DNR for additional benefits. Some of the requirements for especially the hydrology of these wetlands that we're restoring have to be maintained in a certain way, and so they aren't necessarily all eligible for the same type of credit for the use. We do try to make sure that if there is another use available, that we are using that, such as the ones that we work with DNR in order to maintain for waterfowl production or things like that. But they are not necessarily overlapped for flood.
Okay. Anyone else? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more follow-up on that statistic from 2009 to 11. So you said there were 278 acres impacted. So does that mean we replaced 556 acres for $6.1 million? And if so, how much is that an acre? I'd like to know that.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Ms. Blackburn.
Senator, I'm sorry, I didn't get all your math, the 500 and...
Well, I'm just saying, you said there were 278 acres impacted, mm-hmm. So did that mean we needed to replace twice that amount, 556 acres?
Mr. Chair and Senator, not everything has to be replaced on a 2-to-1. There's a sliding scale based on where you're going and the type of replacement you're doing. And so what we needed to do was replace 473 acres.
Okay. So, all right. So 473 acres cost $6 million. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. That just sounds rather high.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump, this is very interesting.
This is one. It's kind of like a dog chasing his tail. That does not include all of the acres of wetlands that have been created by the farmers who have plugged their ditches and have agreed to, you know, allow their land to go back into wetlands. And literally that's thousands and thousands of acres that have occurred across the state that way. We don't get any credit for that, though.
Might need to change that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Ms. Blackburn.
If I could, actually, I think that's a really that's a great comment, because we are working very hard to make sure that farmers, when they're out in their fields and they do want to take activities like that, are made aware of the options to do things like this. They can be part of a wetland banking program. They can be part of a ag mitigation banking program. And so we are actually working with some other agencies and the federal agencies, NRCS, to make sure that there is a broad awareness of the programs that are available to farmers for these purposes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langsett.
Mr. Chair, just to kind of follow up on what Senator Stump is saying, like we have what they call the North Ottawa Project up in the Red River Valley. It's 1,600 acres, and it impounds 1,600 acres. Well, there's 75 square miles of water that go in there, and in the spring, it's all underwater, the full 1,600 acres. And then they let some out, but the plan is to have cells on the one side of it there that will, you know, be wetlands that can be controlled and everything. And I was just wondering, it would seem like that certainly should qualify. Out of the 1,600 acres, I think it'd be, you know, 400 or 500 acres or something that will be permanent wetlands within that compound.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Blackburn or Senator Stump first.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Langseth, I think you're absolutely correct. I think what we have going on is that there should be better coordination between different agencies. I mean, it's like I say, we've spent literally tens and maybe even hundreds of millions of dollars on these flood projects, flood mitigation projects, and a wetland doesn't have to be wet. I mean, you have different types of wetlands and different periods during the year when land may be wet and may not be wet. And so I think, like I say, I think it's a missed opportunity, because we're funding these projects anyway, that we should, on the other hand, get credit for them so that we can and then use them to replace local government road projects or whatever.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langsett.
Senator Stump's country, near Warren, Minnesota, there's that one that's 700 and some acres, and that was all completed. And when we were there, I've never seen so many birds in all my life. I mean, I never saw a natural wetland that had as many birds as that one did. So, yeah, I think we should follow up on that and find out if none of that is being is qualified, and why not.
Ms. Blackburn, I don't know. You're in the middle of this one now.
that's fine, Mr. Chair. I do know that some of those projects that have been up in the Red River Valley have taken advantage of both aspects of the wetland banking program. And I think it's really important to remember, and I certainly am sensitive to the need that we have, you know, we have to look at all those different programs, and we have limited resources, and we need to take advantage of opportunities where they are. And we will continue to talk about that, talk with DNR, talk with others. I wanted to make sure that you understood this program and the need for this program, especially as it relates to local road authorities and them making sure that they have some certainty when they are putting in their road projects, that they have available credits and that it's at a reasonable and predictable price so that they can do their road projects.
I'm just reminded that we are now halfway through your presentation, and that there's another part dealing with the Reinvest Minnesota REM. Why don't we just move to that in the essence of time and hear about REM? Welcome to the committee. Would you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Sheila Vanney, and I'm the Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And our organization supports $25 million in bonding for the Reinvest in Minnesota Reserve Program. Senate File 1795 reflects this request, and Senators Deems, Ingerbitz, and Langseth Miller, and Kilosh have authored that bill. Since 1986, the Reinvest in Minnesota Reserve Program has played a key role in Minnesota's efforts to restore marginal and environmentally sensitive agricultural land to protect soil and water quality and support fish and wildlife habitat. The RIM Reserve Program, administered at the state level by the Board of Water and Soil Resources and implemented at the local level by soil and water conservation districts, compensates private landowners for voluntarily granting conservation easements and establishing native vegetation habitat on economically marginal, flood-prone, and environmentally sensitive or highly erodible lands. Since 2000, Bowser and SWCDs have successfully partnered with the United States Department of Agriculture to leverage over $300 million in federal dollars through the Wetland Reserve Program. So some key reasons for supporting an additional $25 million in RIM Reserve Program funding this year are that landowner demand continues to outpace the available funds for this program, that there's an opportunity to leverage $40 million in federal Wetland Reserve Program funds if all $25 million in RIM Reserve were matched with WRP funds, and that there's an opportunity to target some of the expiring lands currently enrolled in the Federal Conservation Reserve Program that are also marginal and sensitive and could be enrolled permanently through state protection through the RIM Reserve Program. There are a couple handouts that I believe you have in front of you. One is a fact sheet with Bowser and MASWCD's logo on it that captures some more of this information. And another is a letter that's been co-signed by a broad spectrum of organizations that support this funding in this year's bonding proposal. And with that, I'll turn it over to Julie Blackburn with Bowser for some more of the details of the program.
Ms. Blackburn.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I just wanted to describe to you again a little bit about the RIM program. When Mr. Lacrosmo from DNR was up, he spoke a little bit about the RIM program that they have, and that's their RIM match from the license plates. The RIM program that Bowser administers is really kind of the bulk of RIM that the state has. We work with private lands, private landowners, in order to attain conservation. The RIM program was created 25 years ago. Governor Perpich created it at a time when it was economically very unfeasible, actually, to propose a conservation program like that. So we've been doing this program for 25 years. It is the most successful wetland restoration program in the state, and we target those areas of the state that have lost the majority of their wetlands. And so this is another wetland creation bill. And just so we get it off the table right away, we can't do both conservation and regulatory programs on the same piece of land. So in case that conversation came up a little bit later. We have done a tremendous amount of easements. 5,500 permanent easements have been acquired through this program. An important component of the permanent easement is that the land is still held in private ownership. It is still on the local tax rolls. It is something that we will always make sure that there is the conservation plan in effect. We do regular monitoring of those easements to make sure that there's no infringement on the easement. But it is kept in private land, and those private landowners do have the ability to use it, although there are some limitations on the use. It is to be kept in conservation, but it is left on the private tax rolls. We do implement this program programmatically, which means we work with the SWCDs. We do sign-ups. They are incredibly successful. Even in these times of very high crop prices, we have more than enough people signing up for these programs because they know how important it is. It's also, I think, very important right now to look at the timing of this. We have been very successful on getting bonding and some other appropriations from other funds for the RIM program. However, we do know that the Farm Bill, the federal Farm Bill that provides the $1.6 match to every dollar that we're putting in, the federal Farm Bill is up for, debate again this year. And so for its five-year rewrite, We do anticipate that there are going to be some major changes to that farm bill that affects the match coming to the state. That, along with the expiring CRP, with over 800,000 acres of expiring CRP, what we're hoping to do is to continue to really laser-like target the most sensitive and critical lands that are coming out of CRP and make sure that there is a permanent conservation easement put in place where the federal government has already done that conservation practice. We also want to make sure that you take a look at that folder and understand that along with these dollars that we're bringing in, it's 1.6 federal dollar for every state dollar that's put in, we are generating jobs. Again, these are building wetlands. They're building other kinds of projects out throughout the state where we are using local contractors, local seeding folks, local surveyors. It is a locally initiated project that has local benefits. And so that's a little bit about that RIM program. Again, it's 25 years strong. It is the most successful wetland restoration program in the nation, and it is right now really a priority for the agency to continue to keep it strong. And with that, I would take any questions.
Questions? Ms. Blackburn? No questions. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time with us this evening, and we appreciate the information. I suspect we'd be able to find you, as I see your name and phone numbers on here, if necessary. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Lastly, from the Department of Agriculture, Jim Borboom. I'm sorry, Borboom. Jim, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Jim Borboom, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. With me this evening is Gary Horbath. He is the director of our Laboratory Services Division, and he's got a couple minutes where he'd just like to highlight the request from the Department of Health and Agriculture on the capital improvement to our laboratory services. And then I will follow with a brief review of the Rural Finance Authority.
Okay. Mr. Horbath, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee here, my name is Gary Horvath. I'm the lab director at the Department of Agriculture. I'm here to quickly just go over our capital bonding project, which will tie in the emergency electrical generator from both the Freeman Office Building and the Lab Services Division, the lab building on Robert Street, which will provide continuous full capability operation in the event of a catastrophic failure of the supply of electricity. Right now, the building is not fully operational. It basically allows for an orderly and safe shutdown of the building, but we are not operational, and we'd like to correct that error that happened during the construction because of cost overruns. A decision was made to go with a smaller life safety generator. And we just feel it's in the best interest of public health and safety to correct that situation in the case of, you know, God forbid, the worst-case scenario. So we're asking for $706,000 to do this work. And with that, I'd take any questions you may have.
Questions for Mr. Horvath? Just in a sentence or so, what kind of samples do you do in your laboratories?
Mr. Chairman,
bacteriology or
excuse me,
bacteriology or
yes. Well, okay. We are the main food safety testing laboratory. Okay. We do all of the microbiological pathogen testing, the peanut butter outbreaks, that type of thing. We also are the state's pesticide residue lab to support the federal EPA FIFRA work. So we do all human exposure, spill, drift complaints, environmental fate, groundwater monitoring under Clean Water Legacy. We get money there. We've been doing groundwater monitoring since 1985. We do lead and venison. We had that issue. We produce the PCB results for fish contamination survey and mercury work for the DNR. We're the DNR's main laboratory. Feed, fertilizer, agricultural inputs. We're a very diverse laboratory.
No, I haven't. Anyone else? Questions, Mr. Horvath? Okay, we continue on, Mr. Beerbohm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. You should have a handout in your packets, and it would be titled Rural Finance Authority 2012 bond request. And what I'd like to do just to highlight the purpose and the use of the bond proceeds that we're requesting and how we partner with various financial entities to deliver low-cost financing. The Minnesota Rural Finance Authority was established in 1986. It was established during some very adverse financial times as a restructuring program to help farmers who had loans at that time that were undersecured and were not cash flowing to help them essentially refinance that debt. Today, the Rural Finance Authority partners with more than 400 agriculture lenders throughout the state of Minnesota. Many of them are commercial banks or community banks or members of the Farm Credit System. Through the partnership with these financial entities, we can provide low-cost financing to Minnesota farmers. The request for $33 million is to allow us to sell bonds. The proceeds from the sale of the bonds then are used to buy participations or a portion of a real estate loan originated by these ag lenders. Once the loan is closed and we start to receive the repayments of the principal and interest on an amortized payment, those monies are deposited into a dedicated account and used to repay the debt service on the bonds. So the unique thing about this program is that it is user finance. We are able to pay back the debt service on the bonds from the principal and interest receipts that we get on the loan participations. The Rural Finance Authority has had a long record of success in the 25 years have been in place. We've issued over 2,600 loans for $178 million. The losses during that time frame is about $280,000 on 17 loans, which is really a phenomenal record when you look at industry standards, usually are not that good. Probably the reason for that is we have a very diverse loan portfolio, and the other reason is that the ag lenders that initiate these loan requests to us are really doing their due diligence in putting the loan packages together. The back side of the fact sheet just talks about their five loan programs that are funded from the sale of bond proceeds. The first one is a basic loan program. We also have a seller assisted and ag and improvement program. Those three are primarily targeted toward entry-level farmers with a net worth of about no more than $415,000. And the way the Rural Finance Authority works under those programs, it would purchase 45% of a qualifying loan up to $300,000. The other two loan programs then would be for a livestock expansion and restructure two loan program. Again, 45% up to $400,000, net worth at $782,000. So the unique thing, again, about this program, it's a great public-private partnership. It's one that is user finance and has had an excellent track record. And so the request for $33 million is to continue to offer this low-cost financing to Minnesota farmers. And this would allow us to go for another 2 years plus 1 year in reserve. The annual activity on the loans is about $10 to $11 million in the past 5 years. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll answer any questions.
Senator Jungbauer has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking through your sheet here, and what I'm just trying to understand really quickly. So we bond, you give out the loans get paid back. Where does the money go?
Mr. Beerbaum.
Yep. Good question, Mr. Chairman. Senator, the cash from the sale of the bonds is used to purchase the loan participations originated by an ag lender. Mm-hmm. Again, we buy that $300,000 or 45% up to $300,000. Then as the amortized payments come in, they go into a dedicated account at the Minnesota Management and Budget. That account is swept on December 1 each year then, and the money is used to repay a debt service on previous bond issues.
Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so it just seems like a revolving fund that pays itself back, and it looks like it's been very little risk for a long time.
Mr. Beerbaum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does, Senator, it does act like a revolving fund. We have to come back about every 3 years or 2 or 3 years and ask for a request to sell bonds because, again, because of the fact that the principal and interest receipts are dedicated to pay back previous bond issues. So it has that character of a revolving fund, but it's
but
not.
You have to keep funding. Yeah, okay. Great, thanks.
Anyone else? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Borboom, so the repayment of the loan plus the loan losses plus some administrative expenses equal the bond repayment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the
Mr. Brabaugh.
We do get a general fund appropriation to cover some administrative costs. There are three staff people that are dedicated or working under this program. The monies that we're seeking for the bond authorization, there's a unique provision in the state constitution that allows a sale of general obligation bonds for the development of agriculture resources. So the simple model is that once the bonds are sold, the cash from the sale of those bonds is used to purchase these loan participations, and then the principal and interest receipts from these loans, they may be amortized over 20 years or they may be amortized over 30 years. We hold them for 10 years. Those receipts then are deposited into a dedicated account, which is used to repay the debt service on the previous bonds. So there's no other monies pulled out of those receipts or those payments.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still struggling with the fact that every few years we have to bond some more money.
Right.
If this was truly operated like a revolving loan fund, it would seem to me that if every few years we have to be putting in another $30 million or so, that this is a very growing program. Otherwise, I guess there's probably something I'm just not quite understanding.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, what I can do is I actually have a copy of a financial statement that I can show you that shows when 1986 there was a $50 million bond authorization, and there is probably about eight different authorizations that the legislature has given over the years, over the 25 years. So it's the matter is that if we sell, let's say we sold $10 million in bonds, we or the Rural Finance Authority has an obligation to pay back that $10 million. Once that obligation is satisfied, that event is closed. And so in order to continue the program, we're coming back about every 2 years or 3 years with a request for new bond authorization.
Okay.
So,
I'm sorry. I finally got it. Okay.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And yeah, I was struggling too, and it almost seems like we should be making it into a revolving fund so that if it has a history, if it has a known amount that seems to work, I think that's something to think about next legislative session to try to make it that way. It just seems more appropriate and easier to do if it actually has a good long track record of working and not losing money.
Mr. Borbaum.
Mr. Chairman, I've thought about that same model. When the Minnesota Management and Budget sells bonds, again, if they sell a $10 million bond issue, that $10 million is immediately deposited into an account where it's held until we have the loan demand that's sufficient to draw that down. Once a bond issue is made, we pay 18 months interest up front and then annual interest thereafter, and then at the maturity of the bond, we pay 6 months interest plus the face value of the bond. So it's actually this model works better because there's a lower cost to us. If you were to set up a revolving account, I'm not sure what the cost structure would look like, but I can do some homework on that.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Good project, Senator Magnus?
Yes, sir, it is. It's great record.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, it is. It's got a great record, and it's helped a lot of folks. And, it does things to help folks be more efficient and more competitive, and that's good for all of us in the long run.
Okay. Anyone else? If not, that is our agenda for this evening. Thank you so much, both, for coming tonight and working us through the Agriculture Department of Agriculture requests, and we do stand adjourned.
No,
thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Feeling great.
One of those locks we don't have.